My name is Jacob, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a drug addict and egotistical, narcissistic asshole. So I fit right in, right? You know, when I was asked this morning to be the 10-minute speaker, I said yes, no problem. You know, and the reason I was so quick to say yes is because this fellowship saved my life. These rooms, this program saved my life. And I am so grateful today to be here. So grateful to be in this room with people that I can relate to. With people that aren't going to judge me. I took my first drink when I was 16 years old. Played sports in high school, football, wrestling, baseball, and it was, you know, drinking on the weekends with the guys and partying. It was fun. You know, we did it to fit in. When I graduated high school, I joined the United States Army and was stationed in Italy. It was with the 173rd Airborne Brigade, and the Army allowed me to become a professional alcoholic. The structure protected me from the repercussions of what my drinking caused. First time I ever went to jail behind my drinking, I was stationed at Fort Eustis, Virginia. Ran up a $200 bar tab at a Ruby Tuesdays and don't know how I ended up in the back of a police car. My first sergeant came to bail me out and I thought, okay, I'm done. Went to court, the judge dismissed it because he said he'll let the military take care of it. My company commander gave me a slap on the wrist. He gave me 30 days of extra duty and said, don't do that shit again. I said, well, hell, if this is the only repercussion I'm going to suffer, I can get away with this. Yeah. You know? While I was stationed in Italy, I discovered that drinking wine is the national pastime in Italy, and I did my very best to compete. I deployed to Iraq in January of 2005. I saw my first combat action in Fallujah, more in Sadr City in Baghdad, and one of the first things I did while I was in Iraq is I found a black market dealer who sold alcohol. Being that it's a Muslim country, alcohol is illegal, and I didn't care. American dollars spoke, and they spoke well, and I continued to drink. My job specialty in the military, I was a medic, so I was in charge of 130 guys in my company and making sure they stayed alive. You know, that also meant that I had the authority at the company level to write prescriptions. And I took full advantage of that authority. I never went without alcohol, and very few times did I ever have to pay for it. You know, once again, the Army allowed me to be a professional alcoholic, and it was a full-time job. After I redeployed from Iraq, I was stationed in Germany, where I discovered that the national pastime there is drinking beer. And I did my very best to compete with them as well. February of 2006, I deployed to Afghanistan with the first operational striker brigade ever put into the field. Still a medic, still with 130 guys in my company. I was the guy in charge of keeping the shooters and the ground pounders alive. You know, I was God on the battlefield. I kept my guys alive. You know, they were putting bullets down range, and I'm making sure they stay alive. And that fed my ego to the point where I didn't think I was touchable. You know, I really did believe that I was 10 feet tall and bulletproof. You know, and I have two combat tours to prove that fact, so I can drink as much as I want to. While in Afghanistan, I also discovered their national pastime, which is opium. I did my very best to compete with them as well. August of 2006, I heard for the very first time that my life was unmanageable. August 19th of 2006, my unit was being replaced by the 10th Mountain Division. So we were running an integrated patrol through three villages in northern Afghanistan. The unit that was replacing mine, their medic, was a very good friend of mine. He was my battle buddy in basic training. He was my battle buddy in training school. He was also my battle buddy in jump school. This is Christopher Sitton was a man that I trusted my life with, and he trusted me with his. And the morning of August 19th, before we left on our convoy, Chris and I had an argument about who was going to ride where in which Humvee. I had made it a practice that every time I went on a patrol, I would ride in the lead Humvee with my guys. Besides, I couldn't take care of them if I couldn't be up in the front with them. You know, at this time I was an E5, and a sergeant is supposed to lead from the front. So that's what I did. Chris also did the same thing. You know, so we argued about who was going to ride in the lead Humvee, and Chris finally told me, he said, "You know what, Jake? I know a perfect way to settle this. Let's flip a quarter." That's how we used to settle every argument. Basic training and training school would flip a quarter. Let fate decide. Let the universe decide. So he flipped a quarter, and I called it. I called heads, and tails came up. Chris said, "All right, I'm going to lead Humvee." And I rode four Humvees back. 3 hours out of our firebase, that lead Humvee hit an IED. Instantly killed the driver, the gunner on top of the Humvee, and the shotgun rider. And by the time I got to that Humvee, it was on fire, and Chris had sustained 90% third-degree burns over his entire body. Had glass and shrapnel stuck in his throat and was bleeding out. By the time I got to him, all I could do was call for an air medevac and hope they got there fast enough. Due to weather conditions, that air medevac was denied, so we had to drive him 3 hours back to the fire base. And I pulled that glass and shrapnel out of his throat so he could breathe, but I had to keep my fingers in periodically so he wouldn't bleed out. By the time we got him back to the hospital, it was a level one triage, and the doctor told me, we got him on the operating table, and the doctor told me, "Sergeant, you're going to have to pull your fingers out so I can operate." I told him, "No, sir, if I pull my fingers out, he's going to die." He said, "Well, I can't operate. I can't try and save his life if you don't remove your fingers." I said, "Okay." I pulled my fingers out of Chris's throat, and he flatlined. The doctor spent 22 minutes trying to bring him back. And then he called it. I walked out of that field hospital covered in dirt and grime and Chris's blood. I crawled inside of a bottle of Jack Daniels and I swallowed half a bottle of oxycodone. That was the very first time that I'd ever gotten drunk in uniform. That was the very first time that I ever gotten so drunk that I couldn't clean my weapon. My first sergeant found me 8 hours later, passed out in a bunker. Pulled me out of the bunker, stood me up, and he told me, "Sergeant, your life is unmanageable. You need to unfuck yourself right now. We have guys that still need you to operate." I received an honorable discharge from the Army March of 2007. Full-blown alcoholic and heroin addict. But now I didn't have the structure of the military to save me. I didn't have the Army to as a buffer for those repercussions. And I turned to something that I was good at. I had two combat tours of kicking down doors and taking stuff from people that they weren't supposed to have. Weapons, money, drugs. So that's what I turned to. And that progressed into my life of crime. I robbed 6 gun stores in 2 states, Kansas and Missouri, and went on a 3-state crime spree in November of 2007. And the ATF task force after me got in a 45-minute high-speed chase along Interstate 70 just west of Denver, Colorado. When the dust settled, I was sentenced to 11 years in federal prison, where I continued to drink and use as many times as possible throughout the day. I figured if I was just numb to everything, it would just all go away. I signed my release papers from federal prison November 7th of 2017. And I knew what I had to do. I got this. I told everybody. I told my parents, my family, told my probation officer. I got this. I'm good. I don't need any help. I know what to do. I was so good. I was so set in that I had this all figured out that I lasted 9 days on federal probation before six U.S. Marshals rearrested me and sent me back to jail. My probation officer looked at me and said, "Jacob, your life's unmanageable." No shit. I'm a slow learner, but now I was starting to figure out that there was something wrong. My probation officer pushed the court for a two-year violation, wanted to send me back to prison for 2 years. The Veterans Justice Outreach Program stepped in on my behalf and petitioned the Federal District Court for a program. They told the judge, "This guy needs help. He needs something. Prison obviously didn't fix what was wrong with him. Let's try a program." I was all for it. I didn't want to go back to prison. And I figured, hey, it's the VA. They might know something. They can help me with my PTSD. They can help me with these mental health issues that I have now. So I was all for it. I jumped on it, thinking that I was going to a mental health program. I got picked up from the VA hospital in Fresno on January 8th after getting released from county jail, and they drove me to Porterville. They dropped me off at the PAR Center in Porterville. I read the name there. I said, "Wait a minute, Porterville, alcohol and addiction recovery. Oh, no, this isn't for me. I don't need that. I'm not a drug addict or an alcoholic. You got the wrong spot." I told the director and my counselor, I said, "I don't need this. I don't need this program. I'm not an alcoholic or a drug addict, but that's great what you're doing for other people, but they need it. I don't." And I was very kindly told that if that's the case, then go back to where you came from. If you don't want to try this program, go do what you're doing, because your life was so manageable on your own. Go back to it. I said, "Huh, I might have a point there." And I said, "Okay, I'll give this program a try. I'll give this program a try simply because due diligence requires this, so I can tell you that this program didn't fucking work for me." That was my goal. Do the program and prove that I'm not an alcoholic or a drug addict, and this program wasn't going to help me. Guess what? I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, and this program helped me. This program saved my life. Something that was hammered in every day of this program: honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. Those three, every single day, I had to be honest with myself. I had to be open-minded to the fact that what I was doing, the way I lived my life, my will, didn't work. I had to be willing to try this just a little bit. Just crack the door a little bit. Try something different. Today I have 70 days consecutively clean and sober, and it's by choice. This program works for me. And I thank God every day for the gift of desperation, because I had my back against the wall and I was desperate. Desperate for a chance to live life. It doesn't have to be great. It doesn't have to be fantastic. But this life, clean and sober, is better than what it was yesterday. Definitely better than what it was 12 years ago when I went to prison. And I'm grateful that by the grace of God, I can say, I don't have to drink, I don't have to use, and I can be okay with me today. I can be okay with life. And with that, I want to thank each and every one of you in this room for being open and inclusive when I walk through those doors. There is something powerful in one alcoholic helping another. thank you. Thank you for opening your arms to me. This program has saved my life, and each one of you are a part of that. With that, I'm Jacob. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to keep coming back. I'm Jacob, and I'm an alcoholic still. It is my pleasure and honor to introduce our main speaker, Nancy A. from Fresno.
So you know who you're dealing with? My name is Nancy. I'm an alcoholic. Thrilled to be clean and sober and at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous today. Give all thanks to the Creator for taking pity on me and taking me to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And then when that didn't work, taking me back again. So I apologize for being late. Can I see, do we have any newcomers here today? Anybody in their first 30 days? Anybody in their first 60 days? Anybody in their first year? Woo! All right. That's right. Well, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we all started out new. So I'm going to qualify. What's this like? What happened? What it was like? And what happened? Yeah. You guys know how that goes. Okay. Okay. So my sobriety date is, it's going to be 6 days on St. Patrick's Day, my sobriety day. I'll be 17 years, one day at a time. In a row, baby, in a row. So for me, let's see. I'll just tell you a couple of things, a couple of stories, and then we'll get into it. So if you're doing prepaid gasoline now, if you have to pay for your gas before you pump your gas, me and a partner of mine are probably the reason that you have to, because back in the days, you could just pump your gas and then go pay for it. And now that doesn't happen anymore, because there were times when I didn't really have any money, we didn't have any money, and we really needed gas because we had places to go. And so there may have been some companies that suffered some loss at our hands. That's one of those things that I still have to work with my sponsor on, how to do that amends. I'm real grateful to be here. Thank you to anybody who was responsible for getting me here this morning. Thank you to my writing partners that came up here with me. It was kind of cool coming up. I'm trying to defrost right now. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the first time on a court card after a Super Bowl Sunday incident that I wasn't responsible for. I had to come get my court card signed, and I did that to meet that need to the judge, and I turned that back in, and that was in 1991, and I filled that commitment, gave it to the judge, and was on my merry way and didn't look back, because I wasn't really ready to do Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'd sit in the back, I'd drink coffee before, you know, in the meetings, because I didn't know what else to do, but I was drinking before the meetings, and then when I was done, I'd go drink after the meetings, so I wasn't finished yet. But every meeting, they read the same things, the 12 steps, 12 traditions, how it works. Every single meeting you go to of Alcoholics Anonymous, they read the same thing. Every meeting. And I'd listen to what was going on in the meetings, and I didn't really relate because all the people in there were older than me, which that's my age now. I'm like, what happened? So, crap. Time kind of sneaks up on you. So they read the same things every time. Somehow a seed got planted. I wasn't paying attention. And then I went on my merry way. And then 10 long years later, 10 long, long years later, I was drinking and using, doing all the different things that we do. And there's no clock in here. Okay, there it is. It's got a glare. So I'm doomed. You're doomed. There wasn't alcoholism. There wasn't drinking in my home, but I was an alcoholic from the beginning. I felt different. You know, how do you feel? I'm the only one. So how do you feel different? If there's only one of you, how do you feel different? Different from what? You would imagine other things. But there was no alcohol in the home, but there was a lot of other stuff, my home life. I remember relating to my niece, who's 16 now. I saw her when she was a little girl, probably about 3 years old, and just regular stuff was going on, not even arguing or anything like that. And she was holding her head in her hands and screaming, like doing this. And I was like, holy crap. And I totally identified with what she was doing. I was like, shit, I used to do that. Be in my house. You know, mom and dad were fighting and stuff like that. What's that have to do with Alcoholics Anonymous? Well, I just never felt right or okay. I wasn't going to tell you my normal story, but I only have one. So what do you do? I was going to try to make it, you know, bam, let's do it up. I'll give you one more story. I always drank, and I never had a problem with drinking. And when I, after that 10 long years, my higher power used somebody I thought as bait to get me into a program. But the reality is that I was running from a felony. And I was on the run, on the streets, and that's how I lived, was on the streets, in house to house and person to person, whatever, you know, getting handed off or handing myself off. And the people I was running with were getting popped and busted and all this other stuff. And somebody said, hey, Nancy, you know, if you go to a program, they'll squash that felony. I'm like, ooh, that sounds great. And I didn't listen to it and kept going. And then God used that person as bait to get into that program. And I went to the program on December 4th of 2000. And I went in there, that was after going to the Halloween party that my girlfriend was at. She was in that program, and she goes, Nancy, come check this out. She goes, hey, you can come visit me and all this other stuff. And I'm like, oh, okay. And I go in there and I'm loaded and I'm decked out, and I go in the doors and they're having this party and it's all the families. And I went in there, and I didn't know anything about program. I didn't know anything about being sober. I just lived my life, which was drinking and using every day. Every day I was awake, I was loaded. Every time I drove my mom around, I was loaded. Every time I was doing anything, I was under the influence of something. And it was mostly alcohol. I always drank. I love drinking. I love drinking beer. When I first drank, I didn't like it. I didn't like the way it tasted. I thought this is bull crap. You know, and that was, I don't remember my first drink. I think I was probably 12 or something with my cousins. And, you know, I don't remember. It was long, long, long time ago. And it tasted like crap, but everybody else is doing it, and I wanted to fit in, and I never fit in, and I wanted to fit in, and I wanted to be a part, because I felt alone all the time. Every minute I was by myself. And for somebody like me, if you don't like yourself and you're all you got, woo. And then when I did substances and things like that, that intensified myself and made me look at myself in a deeper way, it was even more troubling. Man, doomed. I already lost my place. That's awesome. Okay. All right. So, totally blank. So I did an assessment. I did an assessment form they had at that program. Nancy, do you drink in the morning? Do you drink at night? What do you drink? Do you do this? Do this? And I filled out all the checks and did that stuff. And then the lady, Vanessa Valenzuela was her name. She's like, Nancy, wow. She goes, you did really good. She goes, would you like to come in today? And I was like, whoa, wait a second, hold on. You know, and at that time I was living on the street, so I had about three different piles all around Fresno, California, of stuff. You know, all my important things. And I was like, well, give me a few days and I'll come back. And so she gave me an entrance day on a Friday, and I came. I told I called my mom. Hey, mom, I'm gonna get my shit together. I'm gonna go to this program, and I had to estrange myself from my family because I used everybody. I used everybody up, and it was pitiful. The lifestyle I was leading was shameful. I used everybody, drank and used. I couldn't function without a drink. I was always, you know, hustling my mom for money, hustling, you know, anybody I could for money. You know, mom, you got $5. Mom, you got, you know, I couldn't, I was unemployable. Just pitiful. So I showed up to that program late on Friday. They locked the doors, and so I had to hide out for the weekend, which was normal for me. And on Monday morning, I went in there, and they let me in. And I got to start that journey. Was in there for about 4 months. In the mornings, we'd hold our hands. We'd hold hands with each other, and it was about 54 women. We'd hold hands together and do our morning affirmations, and we'd say our prayer and tell people, you know, tell each other, tell ourselves what we were grateful for. And there was a lot of personalities in there, and most of those women were from prison. And there was two of us that were off the streets, and one lady was considerably older. And out of those 54 women, I don't know that anybody's sober today in a row. I went in there, and in the morning I'd go out on the grass, and I'd take my little towel that we bathed with, the little tiny wash rag of a towel, and I'd put it on the grass, and I'd go out there, and I'd say a prayer. I'd try to pray in the morning before breakfast and at night after dinner. But I didn't know how to pray. Because I was raised in a religion that wasn't accepting of me and who I am, and it really caused me a lot of confusion, and it hurt my feelings really bad. Because I learned these prayers, and I learned these, you know, about these books. And that's how I was raised, and then and I didn't know about sexuality and all the different stuff like that. I was still pretty young, but somebody decided that my sexuality didn't coincide with that religion, and so I didn't get to join when I was ready to join that at age of consent. And so I got my feelings really hurt, and so I walked away from God at that time. And I didn't realize what an impact that would have on my entire life, because I was mad and I was hurt. And for me, for an alcoholic like me, when I'm mad, it's just because I'm hurt. And so I walked away from God, and I've been, you know, was drinking, playing ball, and went on my merry way. Well, graduated from high school and got in a bad accident, and after I graduated, and real bad accident, and there was a bunch of us girls that were sneaking into bars up in Tulare, as a matter of fact, in this kind of area. And we were sneaking in bars, and we were driving home one morning after closing on Saturday night, and hit a Fresno B truck on its Sunday morning load. And I got drug out of the car one way, and the driver got drug out another way, and then they didn't find me till after everything got cleared up. Almost one of the girls got thrown off the site because she was freaking out, and then they found me, and they're like, "Oh my God, Nancy's over here." And what happened was after that accident, I was a DOA, dead on arrival, Jane Doe. I didn't have my ID on me, the thing was is that I was drunk before we even left Clovis to go to that damn bar that afternoon. I mean, I don't even remember anything. I was hammered, and nothing really mattered because I was, I was like, just having a good time, and that's how my life is. I'm just having a good time, not really paying attention. But after that accident, I was 18 years old, and every weekend, the phone would be. We'd be getting ready for the weekend, all of my friends, and after that accident, it freaked everybody out, and my phone quit ringing. It stopped because that accident scared everybody. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to treat me, and I don't know if they knew how to treat anybody else, but it affected me, and it really put me in a depression, and I didn't really understand what that was about. I didn't know what depression was, but it really intensified my drinking, really heavy duty, and I was drinking to die, and I was almost 19 years old, and just hardcore drinking. And then, of course, I was doing other things on top of it. So, well, how much time do I got? Am I over yet? What time does this damn thing end anyway? That way I can look at what I'm working here with here. So I got in that program. My little friend was in there with me. She started using, and I got mad, and so I said, you know what? They always told you, you don't ever have to use again. When I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I went into that program, we got to go out to outside meetings a couple of times, and Oh, yeah. And so I was going in the morning. Okay, I've lost my place. Sorry about that. So in the morning, I tried to pray on the grass, and at night, I tried to pray on the grass. I'd left my higher power. I was like, you know, do this. And then, so I was trying to do something different in this program, because while I was in the program, I had to do a couple of anger management classes, or, you know, packets, because I had little angry issues. I don't know where that came from. And so I had to do some writing, which is kind of four-step stuff. And so when I was doing the writing, I discovered that my ideas I had in my head, which was the law, and what I'd written down were two vastly different things. And I was like, holy crap, and that was my truth. And I was like, crap. So I really had to look at, Nancy, this isn't probably correct. And so I was, it made me open to what you people in these rooms like this were telling me. And it was new stuff, because the old stuff was, you know, my best thinking got me here. My best thinking got me into that program. My best thinking got me a felony. My best thinking got me living out of my car. I didn't have a car. Oh, that's right. I didn't have a car. Oh, yeah, never mind. Okay. My girlfriend had a car, and we were one of the ones that would have to get out of our car like the Dukes of Hazzard, because we couldn't open the doors because they got hit. You know what I mean? We were one of those. Okay. And then one time, and I don't steal. Like, I don't, it's not my DNA to steal, but I'm a liar, a cheat, and a thief. And if you put alcohol on me, it's all bad. So this one time I got talked into, because we didn't have any money. God dang it. And I don't steal. I turn to water, if you know what I mean. I want to go poop. Something's going to happen. And somehow I got talked into doing this freaking, doing a beer run. So I go into this kind of dang store, and I don't know if it couldn't have been a 7-Eleven, but it was over there off of Maple and Olive, kind of by the Alano Club, right? It's a different store now. And I got in there, and I don't steal, and I'm not a sprinter, so it's all bad from the beginning. I don't know how it happened. I think I was loaded. And so so my partner's waiting for me out in the parking lot. The door's open, and the guy's looking at me like, because I probably was like, I'm sure I was 90 pounds lighter. You know what I mean? Sucked up, pale, skinny. My hair was a lot shorter. And so I got to a couple of 12 packs, and this guy, he was on to me, man. It was all bad. And so I put my stuff on the counter. He goes behind the counter, ring me up, and I go, bam, and I make a break for it. I hit the door, and one of the doors was locked. I didn't know it, so I lost one there, bam. And this guy was on my tail, man. He was already, like, he jumped the corner. Oh, my God. So I was out with one 12 pack. I threw it in the car. And he's on my tail, and she's like, go, go, go. And I'm like, go. And I put my hands on the armrest and the other one on the seat to get in there. And I'm trying to call in, and she peels out to go. And I grabbed, ultimately, I lost the other 12-pack, and I got drugged from the car and lost part of my knee. And like about, I don't know, 10 years later, a piece of glass came to the surface from the knee wound and stuff like that. So, like, I'm not very good at stealing. It was a no-win situation in that. I lost both 12-packs, no beer, got a bad wound. I'm lucky I didn't get a terrible infection, but that's where my alcoholism took me. It was awesome. And, you know, I get to live to tell about it. Ah, it's crazy. Stupid stuff. I got millions of those stories, but I don't always remember them, but they're kind of fun. Oh, man, that's great. Yeah, so I was out in the grass, and I do that every morning. I'd pray every morning and every night, trying to figure out how to have this relationship with something I don't really, I had a relationship with God way a long time ago, but I was believing what you guys were talking about, God, get a higher power of your own understanding, and that really spoke to me, because God, you know, if God is God with the blonde hair, the big beard, I don't really relate to God. And so in the beginning, I was calling my higher power grandfather, because you said I could call it anything. And I've heard native ways say grandfather. So that made it a relation, had a relation to me already, my grandfather. And then also heard God called creator. And so I did that as well. And I could identify with that. So I'd go in the morning, I'd pray, I didn't know how to pray. So I prayed with my eyes open, I prayed with my eyes closed, out loud to myself. And I was doing these different things in the morning and at night. And I didn't know, you know, I didn't know if I was doing it right, but I was trying. And I was willing to do it. And then one day, one morning, I was out there, and like the wind picked up, and it like caressed my arm. It was, and I was like, oh, okay. And I could feel it on the inside too. And I knew that was God. I was like, all right. So it gave me a starting point at that time, because I could feel it. And then I go along and I got a resentment, and got a resentment, took it back, and I went and used. And I'd leave that program, and what happened was, is that relapse, was exactly what I needed to do. It scared the crap out of me. I didn't want, and I realized at that point, at that relapse, I didn't want to die, because all the other times I didn't want to live. You know, I didn't want to live for a long time. I wanted to die, but I didn't. Nobody was going to give me a gun, and I wasn't going to hang myself, and I was too scared to slit my own, you know, throat or wrist. And so I was just going to drink myself to death. And then when I relapsed that last time, I realized I didn't want to die, and I wanted to live. And so I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I called my sponsor, and she said, Nancy, don't do that again, first off, and get your butt to 90 and 90. And I did that. And I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. I was doing 2 and 3 meetings a day that first year, because I didn't know how to live and how to survive outside of the rooms. Because what I do is I gravitate towards my regular people that are not clean and sober. And then when I'm bored, that's another slippery time for me. So back in the day, the meetings used to be an hour and a half, and now they're like only an hour in Fresno. And I'm like, gee, what do you guys do with the rest of your time? Because I used to spend a lot of time in the rooms. And then I'd hang out with people after the meetings. You know, we'd go out and have coffee, or we'd go out and eat, we'd go hang out on the porch, and we'd do these different things, and we kind of packed up and hung around together because there's safety in numbers. And it's safer when I'm with people that are like me. excuse me. So I was in Fresno. Got my first year in Fresno. I got in a relationship, got my first apartment, had my first job. You know, I was doing these things, you know, baby steps a day at a time. And then I lost the relationship. Relationship didn't work out, and then I was mad. And you know, I kept going to meetings, and then I had an opportunity because of my little broken heart. At that time, I needed another place to live, and so I went to my boss. My boss is, I'm like, I was crying about my, I don't have a place to live. My girlfriend, blah blah blah, whatever, blah blah. And one of my bosses said, hey Nance, well, we got a room if you want to rent it. I'm like, okay. She said, the thing is, we're going to move in about 4 months. We're going to go to Sacramento. I said, well, I've never lived in Sacramento. She goes, well, you can come. Okay. So I talked to my sponsor, and my sponsor said, Nancy. She goes, I said, well, I want to go, but I don't know anything there, and I don't know anybody. And I've only lived in Fresno. You know what I mean? I was only in Fresno. I only knew that place. And I'm going to play with this microphone for the rest of the day. And I'm not nervous, okay? and so she said, you can go anywhere in the world as long as your higher power and meetings are first. And, you know, as long as you're sober, you can go anywhere and do anything. That's your priority. And I said, okay, and I believed her. And so I went to, I moved my stuff, took me a couple of trips to move my stuff to Sacramento, California. And I had a 82 Mercury Capri with a big old, like a 302 motor in it. And I think it was badass. Ooh, man, I love just racing off the line at the light, you know, with all the little guys, the young guys. But so anyway, I took that car up there, and there's a lot of one-way streets up there, and I didn't know anything. We didn't have GPS back then. And I am directionally challenged. So there's like 3 things against me already. So that's how I roll. That's my life. I'm already stacked up against me. So I did a lot of, you know, right-hand turn, right-hand turn, right-hand turn, right-hand turn. You know, a lot of left-hand turn. I'd have to circle around. And I got to know Sacramento really well, and I developed a lot of relationships in Sacramento. I met my first sponsor there, Sean B. I asked her because she was really cute, and then I found out that that's not the way that you get a sponsor. And so that's real. But if you don't communicate well with your sponsor, and if your sponsor's not working with you, then you get a different sponsor, and that's what I had to do. And so if you're new and your sponsor's not working with you very well, and don't communicate, you're not able to tell the truth, you get somebody else that will work for you, because this is a matter of life and death. And so I got another sponsor, Kathy B., and I worked with her. I did my steps with her, and she had I go after work. I was a bean counter. I was doing inventory and stuff in Sacramento. I moved there. I took that job there. I was doing really good. I was a driver. They let me drive, and I had responsibility over about 15 people in my little van. And I was doing really good, doing well, a lot of hours. And then they started. My hours started getting kind of funny, like with the accounting part. Like I wasn't getting all my money, and I was getting resentment about it. And I was crying about it at meetings. I'm like, oh, they're ripping me off. I need another job. And I'd go work with my sponsor. And after work, I'd get all decked up. I'd get showered up, and I usually wore black. I'd go to her house to do my steps, and she had like these three big old yellow labs. And so they'd all rub on me, and I'd pet them, and then I'd leave, and I'd have me covered in yellow hair. I'm like, God dang it, man. Like, how do I go to a meeting and look all cute, you know? And, well, you get to know who I am today. And so, after about the fourth or fifth time, I was like, man. Kathy, I said, listen, my first sponsor, her wife taught me how to bathe dogs. Do you want me to bathe your dog for you? And she goes, do you know how to do that? I go, yeah. She goes, she trained me. She said, Nancy, if you ever need a job or you're ever out of work, you can bathe the dog anyway. She taught me how to cut their nails and do all the different stuff you do. And she goes, Nancy, she goes, my best friend owns a shop in Sacramento, and they've been looking for somebody for like 3 years. You want me to set it up? You want to meet her? I was like, yes. Had coffee, and she hired me to be a groomer. And so, well, she had hired me to be a bather, but he was a groomer position in Sacramento. And so the main groomer was out on vacation, and so she was kind of doing it on the sly. And so the owner had coffee with me, and she said, show up to work tomorrow, and I'll get you going. And she handed me, so the first day I show up, and she handed me a pair of scissors, and I'm like, what are we going to do with these? Because, like, I don't use scissors. And they're like, I'm like, man, this is going to be very challenging. So she started me on the ground level, washing dogs, mostly big dogs. I'd never used scissors before, and it was terrifying because they're razor sharp. But I, one day at a time learned how to work with those dogs. And dogs are amazing. And so I'll tell you what, when I was on that job, those dogs taught me about unconditional love. They taught me about trust. And I learned a lot about patience, developing patience. Because when you're trying to cut somebody's toenails and they're going like this, and that goes on for like 15 minutes per one paw. You kind of have to, and you can't flip out, And I just kept, And so I learned a lot from those dogs that I don't necessarily know that I could have learned as easily from humans. And because I was open to them. And I wasn't afraid of them. They're not going to do a thing, they're not judging me. I don't think about that as people, but maybe my psyche does. Maybe it's always looking at you, people. But so the regular groomer came back into town after her vacation. She's like, who's this? What's going on? And she was kind of she didn't know about me, and so it was a great surprise, and I don't know, it was a pleasant surprise for her, because it was a new person. And so I got to every day, and because it's a real small room that we were grooming in, there's three of us, and I got to tell them who I was every day, and just about my life, and I just talk, but it was mostly about Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of it was about the other part before I got sober. Because I got some really funny material about my life. I can't believe that I made it, that I'm still alive. I lived the life of a cartoon. Even to this day, it's just not a dangerous cartoon anymore. Like I used to run, like because I was alone, I was alone. So I ran by myself. I was always by myself. And my fear, all the things that I thought about myself made me this big person, persona, strong, fearless, like Joshua was saying. And thank you, Joshua, for wherever you're at. Thank you for opening up. I appreciate your story. I appreciate your sobriety and the work that you do. To all the veterans, thank you for your service and your sacrifice. I just lost it again. That's awesome. Never a dull moment, baby. Oh, yeah. Thank you. I was like, dogs? What dogs? Okay. So Cheryl came back into town and she wasn't happy. And then, so she was like, you know, she wasn't overtly mean, but I could tell she was a little gruff. And so, a day at a time, I got to, just work and be humble because I was telling her my truth. I wasn't, I didn't have any kind of confidence or I didn't have any kind of background in dog grooming. I was at the very ground level. I didn't know my ass from a hole in the ground at that point, with the dogs. I mean, I was just on their level. And I like to kiss those dogs. I grab their little snout and I kiss their little nose. And not because I want dog germs, but it's because we're just animals. I mean, we're all animals. Or we're on even keel. And they just happen to be up on my table. So they're on a table, they're in a noose, And once in a while, I'd get their nails too short and it'd bleed. And then they'd look at me like, come on. And I'd stop the bleeding. And then, the next time, three or four times later, they're dying to get in the door. They're crying to get in the door and they can't wait to get on the table and they can't wait to work with me. And it taught me a lot. And before I got to, I was a year into grooming dogs, and it finally occurred to me that I didn't even know that I liked dogs. I mean, that's a trip. I didn't even know that because I didn't know anything about myself because I was so loaded and I was so numb. And I didn't care about anybody. I didn't care about you. I didn't care enough to stop drinking and using. How are we doing on time? 5 minutes? Like, I have no basis here. I went through a few sponsors there. I told my sponsor, Kathy G. I told her something about a relationship I was in. I told her the truth about the relationship and how I felt about the person I was with. And then I got some shame about it the next time. And rather than deal with it to her face, I let her go because I didn't want to tell the truth and that I had made a different decision. So I changed sponsor and got another sponsor, Joyce P., and I had her for 8 years while I was there. I swear to God I'd never go back to Fresno, and then because I hated Fresno and a lot of stuff was going on. And then I was doing some spiritual work. Because I was living half life, I was living in Sacramento, but I was commuting to Fresno a lot for business and for different things. I'd come to Mariposa and Yosemite for spiritual things, for like sweats and different spiritual things, ceremonies that I take part in. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me license, has given me permission to explore my own spirituality, so that's available to anybody here. You can go, your God's your God, whoever you believe in is your, whatever your practice is, do it, and it's good. So I was doing some work on where do I live, because I was living a half life. I was halfway in Sacramento, halfway in Fresno, and it took some very intensive work. And then 4 years later, I got my message, and I was starting to move back to Fresno, came back here to that area, and started grooming dogs again. I've had a couple of different jobs besides grooming dogs. I'll tell you what. Yesterday was my Friday. I got bit on Thursday, and my sister said, Nancy, you need to cut back on your red meat. She goes, because you taste like meat because you get bit so much. I'm like, no, that's bull crap. Because I think that I'm. She goes, you must taste like meat or like a beef kibble or something. But my problem is that I think that I'm faster And sometimes I think that I'm smarter, and that's always going to get me in trouble. I think, no, I don't need that. And I don't have any muzzles. I don't really like to use them because I think that they inhibit the poor dog. And then yesterday I got bit again. I'm like, okay. So I've been grooming off and on for about 14 years, and I don't have muzzles. I don't really like to use them, but I finally broke down and ordered some muzzles yesterday. I'm like, this is it. I'm like, how am I going to ride my motorcycle? My fingers all messed up. I'm like, this is bull crap. But back to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was new, I had about 3 months. I was struggling with my past and the things that I didn't do, and the life that I didn't create for myself. I was 35 years old, didn't have a fit to hiss in, and I was just out of a program. And I was working with my sponsor, and this lady came in from Montana. She was a medicine lady, and she was doing a ceremony out in Clovis, and they were doing a talking circle out there, and some of my friends and all the AA ladies were there, like, come on, Nancy, this Native lady's out here, come on. And so there could be two Native ladies at this ceremony, and so I showed up, my sponsor was having me read the acceptance prayer, and I memorized the acceptance prayer because I couldn't let go of, you know, I don't have a college education, I don't have a career, you know, I didn't have a fit to hiss in. And she kept having me read the acceptance, and I had a problem with that. So when I was sitting in that talking circle, it was my turn. I was holding the eagle feather, and when you hold the eagle feather, you tell the truth and you speak from your heart. And I think that was the first time that I'd held an eagle feather sober. That was probably the first time in my life I'd ever held an eagle feather, come to think of it. Dang it! And I was telling the truth, you know. And I was crying about the same thing. You know, I can't, you know, I didn't do anything with my life, and I'm pissing that and piss and moan. And then all of a sudden, you know, everything just went blink, and that's how my life is. It just kind of, everything fell into place, and I got that. All those things, all those people that I burned, all my family, all the jobs I didn't do, all the people I drank with, all the accidents I've been in, you know, all the crap I did got me to that spot holding that eagle feather that afternoon out in Clovis. All that stuff, all that drama was holding that eagle feather, and I was like, oh, man. And it was, like a huge God shot. And God has, for me, showed me, you know, a day at a time, in flashes, in experiences, in feelings, in stories that I hear from you, from meetings like this, people like you, when you eke out a tear, when you tell the truth from the heart, it touches my heart. I didn't feel for 35 years, I didn't feel anything. I was numb, and I did everything I could in my power to be numb. And working with the sponsor, coming to meetings on a regular basis, on a very regular basis, even today. I come to check in, I come to dump, I come to get rid of my stuff, and I come to see what's going on. You guys still tell me it doesn't work still. I'm glad for that. I don't want to drink and use, I don't plan on drinking and using ever again, because for me, I mean, there's some yets out there I do not want to get. And those are promised to me if I pick up again. Today I get to live amongst my peers. I get to live a good life today. I get to ride a motorcycle. They let me, and it's good. And I'm grateful for my friend Michelle and Pat that had to turn around today. And how much time do I have yet? Today I get to be a worker among workers. So over the past few years I've been able to work with women, and I do that in a spiritual. I haven't sponsored anybody really since Sacramento. I've attempted to have some sponsees here in Fresno the past few years, but I spend most of my time working with women spiritually. And I do it the Native way, run sweats for the ladies. I'm very active in my spirituality. I go to bear dance, I go to the sweats, I do, you know, I go wherever it's called. And I work with the women spiritually there. And what that does is it helps You know, we all get together and we sit in the dirt, you know, around some hot rocks, and we pray together. We suffer a little bit, and it's good for me, and it appears to be good for the ladies too. And we get to share sweat, we get to share prayers, we get to share tears and laughter in that sweat lodge, and it's a sacred place for us. And I get to possibly share my experience, strength, and hope with women inside of that lodge and outside of that lodge. And it's great to be here today. And I don't know what's going on with the time because I have no idea what time I started. So I'm going to keep coming back. I appreciate your time, and I appreciate you asking me to come out here.